From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
I was in my 20s, you know, I was just a kid, a babyface kid, and I got to meet the great African-American writer, John Edgar Wideman, for, you know, like 5 minutes. That was about, you know, he was meeting a lot of people.
Right.
So he wouldn't remember this, but I was starstruck because I had read a lot of his books, Brothers and Keepers and Philadelphia Fire and just a lot of wonderful stuff that he'd written. So I was kind of starstruck, and he was like, okay, young man, where are you from? You know, and I said, I'm from North St. Louis, you know. And he said, well, you know, somebody should be telling the stories in North St. Louis. Maybe you should be writing some of those stories, you know. And for all I know, you know, that might be a speech he gave to every young man he met. I don't know. But it stuck with me, and I thought, man, he's right. There are all these stories right under my nose. I'm always thinking, what am I going to write about? And so I kind of tucked that into my brain. And years later, you know, quite a few years later, when I sat down to actually start doing some fiction, I thought about his advice, and I said, let me start thinking about those stories of North St. Louis and see what I can do with them.
Debar Yassim, associate professor at Emerson College, editor-in-chief of The Crisis Magazine, and author of Only the Strong, published by Bolden Books. Set against the 1970 backdrop of rapid social and political change, Only the Strong explores the challenges and rewards of love in the Midwestern American community, where heartbreak and violence are seldom apart. Moved by the death of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Lorenzo Gus Tolliver decides to abandon his career as a professional leg breaker and pursue a life of quiet moments and generous helpings of banana pudding in the company of Pearl, his new lover. His boss, local kingpin Mr. Good, is also thinking about slowing down, but his affair with Dr. Noel, a prominent pediatrician, complicates his retirement plans. Meanwhile, Charlotte Devine, the doctor's headstrong protege, struggles with trials of her own. Not only does Only the Strong give readers a front row seat to the massive change afoot in America, but also shows how time and age can change a person's heart. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Only the Strong with author Jabari Asim, In Black America.
You know, you go in the barbershop, you go in the corner store, you stand on the corner just waiting for the bus. And all these characters just kind of emerge. And when I was a boy growing up there, I wasn't necessarily outgoing or talked a lot, but I was really nosy. I really paid attention. I really paid attention to grown people and grown men and grown women, how they behaved, how they talked to each other. And I listened a lot and picked up how they talked and that sort of thing. And so a lot of that comes out in the pages of Only the Strong. And I'm remembering characters. Some of the characters are based on people that I knew or people that I saw and didn't know anything about, but instead imagine what their lives may have been like. And then other characters I just kind of made up.
Only the Strong, Jabari Yassim's debut novel, is a compelling portrait of urban life during the first years after the passage of the last major civil rights bill. Massive change is afoot in America, and the characters in this book have front row seats. Only the Strong takes us back to a time when the African-American community had their own world. They were self-sufficient, having their own businesses, which included a cab company, a newspaper, sign shop, grocery store, restaurants, and nightclubs. Born and raised in North St. Louis, Missouri, Jabari Yassim is an author, poet, playwright, associate professor of writing, literature, and publishing at Emerson College. And since August 2007, he has been the editor-in-chief of The Crisis Magazine. Yassim has worked for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, during which time he was the only African-American to supervise book publishing coverage at a major metropolitan daily, and The Washington Post, serving as deputy editor of the book review section and children's book editor. Also, he is the former vice president of the National Book Critics Circle.
For the most part, it was very good. You know, the people looked out for you. It was a safe space for the most part. You know, it was a very segregated time and a very segregated city. And I felt that what I like to say is there was a lot of ambient masculinity in the air. So I was fortunate in that, you know, my father was in my house and raised me. But the observation I often make is if my father had not been in my house, there was still a lot of really responsible adult black men like all around me. So I still could have picked up cues on how to behave and how to think and how to carry myself and that sort of thing. So I look back on those days in particular with fondness and with gratitude, really.
Kind of mirrored my upbringing because there were a lot of attached families in the neighborhood I grew up with. So if dad wasn't there, you also had a surrogate dad. And like many would say that whatever you were doing wrong, some eyes were upon you and it would get back to your parents before you got home.
Absolutely. That's definitely how it was.
Tell us about your work at the St. Louis American and the Take 5 magazine.
Wow, how you know about that?
We try to do our research here.
Oh, my goodness. That's like some of my earliest journalism work. I started doing work for Take 5. My wife introduced me to Sylvester Brown. His brother was putting out a community-based magazine. He was looking for writers. So she connected me with him, and I started writing for him. And we did a lot of good work together. And as a course of doing that work, you know, I was able to attract the attention of the St. Louis American, which is, you know, one of the African-American weekly newspapers in St. Louis. And they hired me, and I worked there for a couple of years, mainly doing features on, like, artists and musicians and entertainers and people like that.
What sparked that initial interest in journalism and writing?
I knew I wanted to be a writer. I didn't know that I wanted to be a journalist. I kind of stumbled into that part of it because actually, when I connected with Take 5, they were looking for fiction writing. Mm-hmm. And I had been writing short stories, so my wife had passed along one of my short stories to the publisher, Sylvester Brown. He contacted me and said he wanted to publish it, so that was fiction. But, you know, we had a conversation, a longer conversation, and a friendship developed, and I said, man, you know, I think I can do this other part of the magazine, too. I think I can do the journalism part. And he was gracious enough to let me try that out, and it worked out. And that's how I ended up doing journalism.
And tell us about your undergraduate studies.
I was an English major at Northwestern, and my concentration, believe it or not, was British poetry. I read a lot of African-American literature during that period, but I read most of it outside of the classroom. Wasn't really offered too much in the classroom. We had a few good African-American teachers who did teach those things. But for the most part, I was educating myself, and I felt like I was playing catch up. It's like I discovered all this African American literature. I thought I knew African American literature. I thought I had a good idea about it. But then I discovered there was all this wonderful writing that I didn't know anything about. So I was reading it really, I was really hungry during that period, just kind of like stuffing my brain with, you know, every black writer in every genre that I could get my hands on. And all of that turned out to be deeply influential.
Tell us about your job at the Crisis. You were editor in chief.
Yeah, I'm responsible for all the editorial content in the Crisis, and we just try to follow issues that are of concern to our readership, which is, you know, not exclusively African American, but is overwhelmingly African American. So we're always looking at, for example, the past couple of years, we focused a lot on efforts to roll back voting rights at police brutality around the country, the continued shooting of unarmed black women and men in questionable circumstances by a heavily militarized police. You know, there are certain themes that we keep uncovering, or we find ourselves having to address issue after issue because certain conditions haven't changed. We also devote some pages to paying attention to African American cultural artists, painters, writers, musicians, etc., mostly who are doing good work but don't get all of the attention that they should. And so we want to shine a spotlight on those deserving artists as well.
I understand. Tell us about your 11 years at the Washington Post.
That was a good time. I was deputy editor of the book review section there. It was a 16-page section that came out every Sunday. And for part of my time there, I also wrote a book review that ran in the feature section of the paper every Tuesday. So I was working on the Sunday edition while also writing a review. And then later in my career there, I wrote a syndicated column for the Post on politics and popular culture. But when I was at Book World, which is the name of the book review, that's where I spent most of my time and energy. I really tried to champion African-American books and look out for African-American writers so that readers who, you know, encountered our section didn't feel like I felt when I was in college, like I was playing catch up, you know. I wanted them to know about the black writers that were out there doing interesting work. And as usual, there were far more good writers than I could give coverage to, you know. So that was one of my regrets. I was enthusiastic and I was energetic, but unquestionably I slept on some people because, you know, it was just no way to get around it. And I still regret that. You know, there's still writers, I see them, and I say to myself, well, I wish we could have given her some coverage or given him some coverage because, you know, they are doing terrific work.
During that period, how did you go about selecting the authors and books that you were going to present a review on?
Well, we had this big room, and we got about, I would say, we got between 100 and 150 books every day from publishers. And so we had some people who would, like, take those books out of the envelopes and put them on shelves in this room, and we organized them by publication date, by month. We usually had up to, like, 3 months of books and upcoming books. And we spent a lot of time in that room, each of us. We had a staff of 10, and each of the editors would spend time in there looking for books in their particular categories that they were responsible for. And one of mine was African-American literature. And then we'd meet on Mondays, and we'd each have a stack of books, and we'd kind of argue about the books, you know, say, this is one we should cover. This is one we should assign a review to. And, you know, sometimes things got shot down because people would argue. But most of the time, we respected each other's opinions. And the next part of the discussion would be, okay, now who can we find who could review this, who would be a good writer for it? And we discuss, you know, a good match. And then, each of us tried to come away with 3 to 5 names for each book. And then we'd contact writers and say, you know, call them from the Washington Post, are you interested in doing a review for us? And sometimes it would be a writer we had never contacted before. Sometimes it would be a writer who'd already written like 10 reviews for us, you know. And we'd have a conversation, and we'd work on getting coverage of that book into the paper.
I understand. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio, and we're speaking with Jabari Asim, Associate Professor at Emory College, Editor-in-Chief of The Crisis magazine, and author of Only the Strong. Mr. Asim, before we get into the book, there are a couple more questions about your career. You received a Guggenheim Memorial Foundation Award for nonfiction?
Yeah, that was in 2009. For the earlier part of my career, I guess you could say, at least where book writing is concerned, I focused on nonfiction. So, you know, during that period, I wrote books like The N-Word, and I wrote What Obama Means, and I edited an anthology of black men writers called Not Guilty, which was about black men in the criminal justice system. And so the Guggenheim Fellowship was in recognition of that work. Since then, I've mostly focused on fiction, I think. So I did A Taste of Honey, and now Only the Strong.
I understand. And speaking of Only the Strong, what inspired you to write this novel?
Well, you know, it was a chance meeting a long time ago. I was at a National Black Writers Conference, and I was in my 20s. You know, I was just a kid, a baby-faced kid. And I got to meet the great African-American writer, John Edgar Wideman, for, you know, like 5 minutes. That was about, you know, he was meeting a lot of people.
Right.
So he wouldn't remember this, but I was starstruck because I had read a lot of his books, Brothers and Keepers and Philadelphia Fire, and just a lot of wonderful stuff that he'd written. And so I was kind of starstruck, and he was like, okay, young man, where are you from? You know, and I said, I'm from North St. Louis, you know. And he said, well, you know, somebody should be telling the stories of North St. Louis. Maybe you should be writing some of those stories, you know. And for all I know, you know, that might be a speech he gave to every young man he met. I don't know. But it stuck with me, and I thought, man, he's right. There are all these stories right under my nose. And I'm always thinking, what am I going to write about? And so I kind of tucked that into my brain. And years later, you know, quite a few years later, when I sat down to actually start doing some fiction, I thought about his advice, and I said, let me start thinking about those stories of North St. Louis and see what I can do with them.
I understand. And the book is centered around the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. back in 68. How did you come up with this plethora of characters?
You know, it's because the community has a plethora of characters. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, you know, you go in the barbershop, you go in the corner store, you stand on the corner just waiting for the bus. And all these characters just kind of emerge. And when I was a boy growing up there, I wasn't necessarily outgoing or talked a lot, but I was really nosy. I really paid attention. I really paid attention to grown people, and grown men and grown women, how they behaved, how they talked to each other. And I listened a lot and picked up how they talked and that sort of thing. And so a lot of that comes out in the pages of Only the Strong. And I'm remembering characters. Some of the characters are based on people that I knew or people that I saw and didn't know anything about, but instead imagined what their lives may have been like. And then other characters I just kind of made up.
Now, we do want people to purchase the book, but I want to go over some of the highlights that I thought were interesting in the book. What are the three main characters that you wrote about in this narrative?
The three main characters? One of them's name is Guts Tolliver. His name is Lorenzo. He's known as Guts. He's a big fella. And he has, you know, made his living for most of his life hurting people. You know, he's been like the muscle for another black man who sort of runs the crime underground in North Gateway City, which is what I call St. Louis in the book. And then there's a pediatrician, Dr. Hortensis Noel, who's really important in the community and does a lot of work on behalf of black children. And the last part of the book is devoted to a young lady named Charlotte Devine, who grew up in the foster care system and is now in college and trying to make her way in the world.
How did you go about developing Guts' character? You had the hard side of Guts, but also Pearl kind of soft him up during the narrative.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, because he's partially based on a guy that I saw sometimes when I was a kid.
I bet.
Yeah, I mean, not a guy that I knew personally, but was in the same room with sometime, you mm-hmm. know. And I was fascinated with him because he exuded a lot of power and potential violence, you know. And you know, you knew he could hurt somebody, but often I saw guys like that kind of, like you said, soften. You know, they show another side of themselves when their woman shows up. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the relationship that Guts has with Pearl Jordan. She can talk to him in a way that other people can't. They can get away with it, you know, because he so respects her and what she thinks of him. And we all know people like that, you know, so I just kind of developed that.
I also found interesting the relationship Mr. Good and Reverend Miles Washington had.
Yeah, the black gangster in North St. Louis, the guy who runs things in North Gateway, his name is Ananias Good. And Reverend Miles Washington is a prominent black pastor there. And they're best friends. And it's kind of weird because one of them's a criminal and one of them's a pastor. But what I did was that relationship began in my previous book, A Taste of Honey, which is set in that same community. And in that book, and I don't want to spoil it because I want people to buy that book too, but in that book I explain how they came to be friends and how odd it was, or how odd it seemed for men on such opposite sides of the law to be so tight.
And how did you come up with the character Rip Crenshaw, the baseball player?
Rip Crenshaw, when I was a kid, I was a huge baseball fan. I idolized the St. Louis Cardinals, which had a number of brothers on the team. And it's really different now because the beginning of spring training last year, Cardinals were identified as one of three major league teams that had no black players at the beginning,
right.
The beginning of the season. So it's real different now. But back then they had brothers and they were bad. You know, they were all stars. And so Rip is sort of a composite character made up of a few of the black players who played for the Cardinals that I idolized when I was a boy.
I understand. And I also found an interesting and somewhat comical Pee Wee Jefferson. He caught Guts on a bad day, and instead of taking him out, Guts made him run in place every time he saw him.
Oh, that's Nifty.
Oh, Nifty. That's Nifty.
Yeah.
Okay.
Nifty, yeah. There's a guy in there named Nifty Carmichael.
Okay.
Yeah, and he used to run a scam where he pretended to be handicapped, disabled.
Mm-hmm.
And it led to someone close to Guts being seriously hurt.
Right.
So Guts sort of punishes him by making him run in place every time he sees him. Just as a way of bullying him and intimidating him and sort of extracting revenge upon Nifty every time he sees him.
Why was it important for you to develop Dr. Noel's character? She, you know, had a private side, but also you interjected, from my understanding, her commitment to health. And I liked the way that you tied in some of the sayings that she had on the wall that she had got from other individuals that helped her get her mind together to pursue her career as a pediatrician.
Yeah, I did a lot of research on black pediatricians in North St. Louis in terms of how they started out. And, you know, they were up against just a lot of crazy stuff, like the sayings you're referring to in her office. The white pediatricians at the time used to have what they call black days. And on black days, you could bring a sick black child to their offices, but only on those days,
right.
Because they believed that, you know, black children, just by their presence, would contaminate white children. So when Dr. Noel starts her own office, she puts up a sign that says, "Every day is Black Day," to make it clear that, you know, Black children are always welcome in her offices. And so, you know, I didn't make that part up. I mean, that's actually true. How it was in St. Louis based on my research.
And also found interesting the book that she had read as a young physician, she found in a bookstore one day.
Yeah, it was like a sort of like an autobiography by one of the earliest Black women doctors who was an actual person, a real person.
Okay.
And I just wanted to put some of that history into the book, you know, and I saw a way to do it, so I did.
And speaking of history, I found it interesting how you tied a lot of historical people, events in that narrative. Obviously, that was a conscious decision that you made when you were writing this.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. One of the questions I kept asking myself when I was developing the story is, you know, what else is happening in the larger community while my story is taking place? So one of the ways I did that, for example, was when Pearl was in the beauty shop and she's looking at Jet magazine.
Right.
You know, I used actual Jet magazines that were telling the community about advances that Black people were making. You know, Black congressman, Black mayor of Newark was elected during that period, was put on the cover of Jet. So I put those kind of things in there so that people could kind of understand what was going on in Black communities around the country and not just in the community that I'm dealing with in the book.
Why was it important for you to also tell the narrative about the three characters, but also interjecting a Black entrepreneurship? You had the sign shop, you had the bakery, you had the barbershop, which was all part of the community.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate you noticing those aspects.
You try to pay attention
of the story. Yeah, no, I really appreciate that because a lot of interviewers are going to miss that. So I'm glad that you didn't give me an opportunity to talk about it. But again, it's a delicate subject because we're talking about the Black community before desegregation.
Exactly.
And before desegregation, there were Black business owners right there in the community. We had no options. We couldn't go anywhere else, so we had to go to these people. And a lot of them were anchors of the community. They were really pillars of our neighborhood. So then barbershop kind of remains that way. So I wanted to pay attention to the barbershop and some of the other places that you mentioned. The sign shop is kind of personal because my dad, he's still alive. He's in his upper 80s. He was an art teacher. And when he came home from teaching art at the neighborhood school, he would change clothes, get out of his suit and tie, put on his coveralls, put his ladders on the back of his station wagon, and go paint signs. He was a sign painter.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a partner in a sign painting shop with a bunch of other sign painters. So as a child, I would kind of sit at the feet of all these sign painters. You know, they'd be smoking cigars and drinking liquor out of cups and painting these wonderful signs and just talking. And I got a lot of my cues in terms of how to be a man, how to be a Black man, from just sitting around listening to these guys. They were fascinating to me. And I loved to be in my dad's company, but also to be in the company of these other men who reminded me of him. And so I started it in Taste of Honey. I put the men of the Black Swan sign shop in Taste of Honey, and I brought them back, and Only the Strong. And if I write about this community again, I'm going to bring them back again because they played an important role in sort of shaping my manhood. And I kind of wanted to show that in the books.
I found it interesting because this particular character, Oliver, who somewhat paralleled an individual that we had in our neighborhood. You always have those neighborhood philosophers that look at the big picture and try to understand that what the man is doing is really not in your self-interest.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. Oliver always walks around with a rolled up newspaper, right? And he's always pointing out the headlines. He knows what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, one of the things that takes place in the book is that when Oliver says, you know, this is what they're going to do next. They're going to close this factory next. They're going to close the hospital next, this kind of thing. The other characters are like, Oliver, you're crazy, man. They would never do that.
Right.
That would be nuts, you know. But I actually based that on real things that happened in North St. Louis because in every instance, Oliver's actually right.
Exactly.
When he calls it out, he's calling it correctly.
And also, you mentioned prior to this last question about the neighborhood, But you also mentioned the devastation that took place, and I assume it was part of urban renewal, that happened in my city, Detroit, that somewhat displaced our neighborhood and some of our businesses when we went into quote-unquote desegregation.
Yeah, and also when they would build a highway.
Exactly.
You know, it would always be through our neighborhood, and so we would lose communities. I didn't get into this too much, I don't mm-hmm. think, in the book, but right. Another thing that they did in North St. Louis was when the universities in the central part of the city wanted to expand, they took over our neighborhoods. And so those are lovely campus areas now for wealthy kids to go to college and live in their swanky high-rise dorms. But, you know, working-class black people used to live there.
Exactly.
And so people like Oliver, you know, it's almost like a curse, you know, of prophecy, because he can see all these things coming down the line. And he complains about them, but people are just, oh, Oliver, shut up, man. You always complaining, you know. But he's right.
I also found interesting, before we run out of time, Mr. Singh, that it was interesting to the point where when you had the narrative, oh, Sharp, that's what I'm trying to get to. Sharp, okay. How Sharp came to be Mr. Good's bodyguard, but then later in the book, we found out that Mr. Good became who he is by taking one of Sharp's cousins out, and there was some animosity towards
yeah.
Good.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for a story to work, you got to have some villains in there.
Exactly.
You know, and Sharp kind of represents that. And also he represents, you know, just sort of, and you mentioned Pee Wee Jefferson earlier. Mm-hmm. He's another character that kind of represents that. They represent the self-destructive tendencies in the community.
Gotcha.
You know, you have people like Dr. Hortensis Noel, who are just devoting their lives every day to building up the community. And then you do have a few people who are like, I'm going to get mine, you got to get yours. And that's how it works, you know. And Sharp is one of those guys, you know. That's what he's meant to represent, those tendencies, those self-destructive tendencies we have in our community too, and our inability sometimes to police those, you know, to check those tendencies in a constructive way without blowing up the community and blowing up our neighborhoods.
Tell us about Adams Higgins Hospital. Was that taken from your experience growing up in North St. Louis?
Yeah, we had a hospital called Homer Phillips, and mm-hmm. it was on North St. Louis, and it had a largely indigent patient base, you know, poor black people, mm-hmm. and it was the only place a lot of us could get health care.
Jabari Asim, author of Only the Strong. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm John L. Henson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.